Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. One of the many problems with the coronavirus pandemic is the toll it's taking on healthcare workers. By many estimates, over half of the medical profession suffered symptoms of burnout even before COVID-19. My guest today is a longtime medical educator and researcher, and he has a new book aimed at bringing native curiosity and true engagement to medical encounters, more than the rote personas that many of us are imbued with in medical school and residency. Dr. Saul Wiener is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he's also deputy director of the Center of Innovation for Complex Chronic Healthcare at the affiliated Veterans Health Administration. He has served as a residency director, medical education dean, and as a university vice provost, among many other roles. His new book is On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients, newly out from Johns Hopkins Press. It's part memoir, part ode to a mentor, and part critique on the way we educate doctors in the United States today, and Wiener offers thoughtful solutions. His previous book, Listening for What Matters, won an American Publishers Award for Professional and Scholarly Excellence in 2017. Dr. Saul Wiener, author of On Becoming a Healer, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Dr. Saul Wiener, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start where we are now, and how are you coping with the pandemic, and what's life like in Chicago and where you work at UIC and the VA there?
Well, I've personally been very fortunate. I've been working in the emergency room on a part-time basis, seeing patients who are triaged as not having symptoms of COVID. Of course, we still take precautions. I supervise a small team of residents. Many of my colleagues are much more involved in day-to-day care of patients who are sick with COVID. And at this point, our hospital has not been overwhelmed, but it's certainly been busy.
And for example, when you, I don't know if in your routine or regular life, is it all emergency room stuff, or do you do outpatient medicine? And if so, is much of it converted to telemedicine?
Well, over the years, I've done so many different things. I'm a pediatrician and an internist, and my time has been divided. Now it's much more adult medicine, obviously because of what's happening these days. I've also done inpatient as well as outpatient care. Over the last few years, it's mostly been outpatient and mostly resident supervision.
And one more of the moment question. So you're in Chicago, and we see these memes going around of Mayor Lori Lightfoot. And what's the situation in Chicago and in Illinois in terms of cases and the wave and whether or not you've hit your peak or not?
Well, people are never sure when that happens until it's passed. I think things are under control in Chicago, although it's not something I've been following all that closely. I think that, we've been getting daily updates. I tune into some of them. They've not had to go. Things have not been as bad as some people fear they might be. We set aside the entire convention center, which we've not needed to use for COVID overflow. At this point, the systems in place, the hospitals, have been able to accommodate the volume. So, for instance, at my own institution, pediatrics gave up their ICU, PEDS ICU, for COVID patients. And we have operating room space where we can also place patients if necessary. But we haven't had to go to that overflow yet, although we have had to use a PEDS ICU.
Wow. Well, I'm glad to hear you haven't overflowed as much as I guess was anticipated. Well, let's turn our attention to your book, On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. And one of the themes that emerged for me that really resonated was this idea of curiosity. And you write that medical students and trainees usually enter the field of medicine with a great deal of curiosity. But unfortunately, the educational system that we have seems to wring it out of us. I guess, could you just elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important problem because curiosity is so essential in medicine, not just from an intellectual standpoint so that you can make a diagnosis, but curiosity about the person themselves. When you're a doctor and you're with a patient and that patient is struggling with a medical condition or set of medical conditions, they have a whole life story, and often there are going to be clues that that person is struggling in some way, that they can't afford a medication or that they've lost a caregiver or that they have some competing responsibility, and there may be clues that something isn't quite right. And if you're curious, you'll pick up on those clues and you'll ask about them, and you'll also start to develop a really engaged relationship with that person, because I think curiosity leads to caring. And so that's just one of many reasons why it's so important. And yet, when we get to medical school, the old saying is it's like drinking water from a fire hydrant, and instead of getting to be curious, you're just desperately trying to keep your head above water as massive amounts of material are thrown at you, and you just have to memorize all that stuff. In the book, I talk quite openly about having a learning disability and how that made it even worse for me. But I think even if you don't, they throw so much at you. I talk about the fact that I think when I was a medical student, we had to learn, 12 different types of collagen, and now I think it's up to 16 or 20, and just a lot of stuff that you're not going to remember anyway, that if you needed to know, you could look up. And I'm really concerned about how that changes people over time and how just the desire to be proactive and ask questions gets replaced by just to memorize and do what you're told. And I think that the problem ultimately is it turns us into task completers. You know, when you're an intern, it's just, okay, get these tasks done, order these labs, you know, see these six patients and so forth. And that brings you up short from, I think, what people need from their physician.
Right. And I mean, as I was reading this, I was sort of shouting, going, yes, hear, hear. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And yet, I guess the critique of it might be, well, yeah, that's all well and good, but we have to learn how to complete those tasks. We have to learn sort of what those tasks are, how to complete them, and how to do them in a timely, efficient, you know, cost-effective manner. And maybe if we lose a little bit on the curiosity edge, then so be it. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have to complete a set of tasks. Whenever you admit a patient, for instance, you're kind of taking over their life. You have to figure out what their diet's going to be. You know, can they get out of bed? What are they going to do during the day? And so forth. Everything is prescribed by you, and I think that is important. You do have to do that, and you have to learn how to do that. But I think there are a couple of problems. One is that if that's all that's taught during your training, you lose, or I would say other parts of you atrophy. And so when you're actually with a real person, with a patient, it's not just a question of, I've got to get these tasks done. It's a question of just losing the capacity, or not even necessarily developing the capacity, to engage with that person as just one fellow human to another, largely because it's often not modeled. And I think there's an even deeper issue. I think oftentimes medical students aren't treated as whole people themselves during their training. I think I have a lot of concerns, particularly during the first couple of years of medical school, about the way students are trained and taught and regarded. So the combination of just being expected to do as you're told, being focused on task completion, and then all of a sudden caring for really sick people and not knowing how to engage, turns you into a kind of task completer. And it's not that you don't need to know how to do some of those tasks. It's that you've lost the capacity to connect or engage, or you haven't developed those skills, and that becomes a huge missing piece. And I don't think it just affects patients. I think it also affects physicians in terms of leading to burnout. You know, if you spend your whole day in practice just completing task after task with patient after patient, ordering labs, writing notes, et cetera, but not forming a human connection, that's not very nourishing for you either. And I think you know, we have a major problem with burnout in this country among physicians. It's about 50%, which is really another form of depression. And I think it is depressing if your whole day is spent completing tasks. And I think that people who go into medicine were ultimately expecting more of themselves and hoping for more. So it's an issue for both the provider, the physician, and for their patients.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Saul Wiener, who is the author of a new book called On Becoming a Healer. He is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And there's so much that you said there that I want to unpack. But I guess let's go back to the fact that you have overcome or have succeeded in spite of a learning disability, and you've been very candid about that. Tell us about the learning disability and how it impacted you, and then I guess what revealing it did for how even decades later people still get in touch with you because you've inspired them.
Yeah, I've been quite open about it. I wrote an article about it almost 20 years ago, and I still get lots of emails from medical students and residents who come across it who are struggling themselves. And for me personally, the first year of medical school was really challenging. I wasn't sure I was going to make it. I was struggling just to pass. And from that experience, I did get some insights that have stood me well. First of all, not to fear failure, you know, to strive to succeed, but to recognize that I can't stake my sense of self, who I am, my worth, on whether I pass a multiple choice test. And that's been really important. I think that most people who go into medicine are just really successful high achievers, and they do really well in tests. And that is kind of a double-edged sword because, on the one hand, you know, it's great to do well on all those tests, but at the same time, it's almost like a Pavlovian response where that's what you think defines you. And ultimately, being a physician is really about being present for people who are suffering, who are sick. And it's not about just showing up and doing great on tests and impressing people. And ultimately, I think that for me, while those early years were really, really tough, I haven't defined myself by being a great student because I wasn't. And so I think that for those who are great students, it can be a problem because they may actually have a tough time when they get to a point in life where they're taking care of real people who are really sick, and they are not really sure how to respond in those situations. That part of them has not really had an opportunity to grow and develop. And so I think that's what's missing in the way in which we train physicians. And I think perhaps having had a learning disability may have been helpful for me in the long run because of that difference.
You know, you go on to suggest, I think, that for a lot of doctors and the trainees that they start out as, by losing that human connectedness, it winds up being sort of a mask or a facade that we might engage in day-to-day practice, but unfortunately it can carry over into personal life. So you wind up treating your loved ones as though they're patients or as though they're... isn't that a fear that you have for trainees and for doctors who are sort of learning that behavior?
Yeah, there's a great quote from a physician who says, you practice, that I have in the book, that you practice medicine the way you live your life. And I think what he was saying is that you can't separate the two. I think one of the problems that you're alluding to is that physicians often develop a persona. So they are early on in their training, and they may model this after other physicians, they start walking into a patient's room and they kind of adopt a sing-songy voice and they've got their white coat on or they don't, you know, but it's sort of, they're holding the patient at arm's length and they develop this kind of patter where they say, hello, Mrs. Jones, how are you today, et cetera, and they sit down at the computer and they start going through their routine, but you don't really know who they are and the patient doesn't really know who they are. They may be very professional, they may be friendly, but they've adopted a kind of persona, and I think that that may come out of just not knowing how to engage as who they are. It may also have to do with a concept that I refer to as a lack of boundary clarity. They're not necessarily secure in differentiating where they end and where the other person begins. So, for instance, if that patient starts to cry or gets angry or expresses strong emotion, they may not know how to respond to that unless they're kind of safely, securely keeping themselves behind this persona. And I think that that starts to bleed into the rest of their life as well in terms of the way they relate to others in this personal sphere. So that's why these two dimensions are connected. And it's so critical to be a content person in life, to be able to have real relationships with people without being in a persona and without feeling like you have to hold others at arm's length to protect yourself. And so I think medical training, unfortunately, pushes many people in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and you have a little bit of a prescription for what you would do. And one of the maybe best examples of that is you write about these white coat ceremonies that most medical schools now do, where when new medical students are indoctrinated, so to speak, they get their white coats and they say a vow and they hear a speech usually from some luminary physician. And you write a speech that's not tongue-in-cheek at all, is what you wish medical students would hear. And I guess it's too long to kind of read on the air, but I would love for you to, if you could, highlight what's different about the speech you would like medical students to hear versus the ones that they typically hear.
Yeah, I think that what medical students need is honesty. And when you come to medical school, it's not an ivory tower. You're going to experience many of the problems that occur everywhere else in society. You're going to experience being treated poorly. There's harassment. You're going to have professors who are patronizing and egotistical, and you're also going to have wonderful people. And everything about life and society bleeds into medicine and medical training, except, of course, the stakes are so high because you're learning to take enormous responsibility and to care for very sick people, and you're also under enormous pressure. But in the white coat ceremony speech that I kind of mapped out, the idea is just to talk to students about the fact that they can't take things at face value. They have to keep their eyes wide open and recognize that they need to be critical of us just as we're going to be critical of them, not in the negative sense, but in the eyes wide open sense, that you know, we're going to model bad behavior as well as good behavior. And they need to learn to pay attention to their own warning signs. If they think that what we're doing and the way we're interacting with patients is not something to model, then question it. Not necessarily out loud, if they feel that that could backfire, but to themselves. And so the idea is to encourage students to be questioning and to think for themselves rather than just lap up everything that's fed to them in terms of the culture of medicine, because so much about the culture of medicine is troubling and concerning, and we want the next generation to improve upon it. And the best way to do that is to encourage them to be critical of what they see. And I think that's the idea behind a white coat ceremony speech that that might ultimately be more, I think, perhaps more helpful.
Yeah, and one of the ways I think that you were incredibly lucky during your formation, really, your whole life, but certainly your medical education, was you had the presence of a mentor who I think was, you said, was your godfather, Simon Auster. And tell us a little bit about Simon, how he came into your life and how he helped you.
So I just had great great good luck. I mean, you know, a number of us have had mentors, and some people have great mentors. I had a really great mentor. Simon happened to be my godfather, meaning my parents kind of assigned him to me. They knew him from before I was born, and to be kind of like a second parent. And he really became critical when I was in my first year of medical school. He was a family physician, about 30 years older than me, and just someone who truly engaged with his patients, but also had a great deal of boundary clarity, meaning that when I talked to him about the struggles that I was going through, he didn't really have any other agenda other than just to be helpful to me and to help me try to grow in my own way, but also to encourage me to trust my instincts. So if I was getting messages from my attendings that I should be more efficient rather than spend time with patients, he was like, well, do you really think that's true? Do you really think that you shouldn't be spending that time with patients? You know, he wouldn't tell me the right or wrong answer, but he would encourage me to think for myself and to learn to trust my instincts. And I feel like that really saved me. And I think that one of the reasons I wrote on becoming a healer is while it's not a substitute for having a great mentor, I do hope it will be a companion to people going through medical school and residency to kind of encourage them to figure out for themselves what they want to be as a doctor, to not take at face value the advice they're given. Some of the advice they're going to get from people is great, some of it is terrible, but to start to trust themselves, to figure out, you know, what to believe, what not to believe, and hopefully a book like this will lead medical students and residents to become reflective about what's happening to them, and to be able to form their own judgments and to learn to trust themselves.
You dedicated the book to him. But in addition, I mean, I think certainly medical trainees and that healthcare professionals all over, whether they be doctors or nurses or physician assistants, could benefit from this book. But I think it's you can go even broader to, I mean, teaching you how to think or how to do a critical appraisal of what you're being taught. And moreover, how to engage. I mean, I think it's really... It is kind of I like the way you phrase it as a it's not a mentor in and of itself or a substitute, but maybe a companion volume. it's I think really valuable that way, and it's very relatable. And one of the vignettes you paint was you were I don't remember exactly what period of your life it was, but you were staying at Simon's home. I think he lived in the Washington D.C. area, and you were at that point I think a pre-med and were going to go and attend a class or a lecture that he was giving, and he sort of woke you up on time to say, hey, come on, we got to get ready. But he brought you orange juice in bed, and you sort of were flummoxed because nobody had ever treated you that way before, and you thought it was a little bit strange. But then can you reflect on that moment?
Yeah, Simon was like that with everyone. I remember being in the checkout line at the supermarket, and you know, the woman was just at the cashier was just saying to everybody, how are you today? How are you today? Doing the usual stuff they're trained to do for customer service. And she got to Simon, and he wasn't being ironic. He just looked at her and said, you know, do you really want to know? And it wasn't like in a sarcastic way. He was just, you know, just taking her at face value. And she looked up at him, and she like, yeah. And then they had a nice little conversation, and I could tell she really felt recognized. I saw him do that in so many situations, just that he was always just really there and present for people, strangers, anyone. It's just his personality. And so I think when he, as a doctor, when he walked into the room, he was just fully present for a patient. The example you gave was just a really simple way in which I experienced that on the other end. So I was just a teenager, and I just wasn't used to the idea that an important person would walk into my room with a glass of orange juice on a tray to wake me up. I just was like, oh my goodness, this is beautiful. and just that's how he was with everyone. And I think that that's just an amazing example.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Saul Wiener, who is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he does research. He's been a longtime physician and educator of students and residents, and author of the new book, On Becoming a Healer, which is just out from Johns Hopkins Press. And Saul, we were talking about your mentor, Simon Oster, who is unfortunately now deceased. But that vignette, for some reason, of him bringing you orange juice reminded me of another person who I've actually had the good fortune to meet personally, who you write about, a very short episode in the book, by the name of Rachel Naomi Remen, who is probably best known for her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. But there's a scene that you write about in the book where she's actually feeling quite low, and she has a long history of inflammatory bowel disease and has had multiple surgeries. But I was wondering if you could just share that with our listeners, because it sort of exemplifies and embodies what you think of as engagement and curiosity with someone who's also being a realist.
Yeah, so Naomi at the time was really, really down because she was quite young. She had this serious bowel condition. She now had an ostomy with, you know, feces coming out into a bag, and her sense of self had just plummeted. She was at a very, very low state emotionally, and she felt unattractive. She felt like an oddball. And one of the things that was happening when she was in the hospital is that various staff would come in to change her ostomy bag and things like that, and they would all gown and glove and just approach her like she was some kind of specimen. And she was so depressed, she wrote, that she had decided to store all the pain meds that were being dropped off at her bedside and just take them all when she got home and kill herself. And one evening, I think it was Saturday evening, a nurse came in who she'd not met before, and this nurse was just like everybody else in terms of coming in to change the ostomy bag, but she didn't do all the gowning and gloving. I mean, she washed her hands, she came in, and she just got into a really friendly conversation with Naomi about what your plans were for the evening. Naomi had actually dressed up for because some friends had sent her some clothing, so she wasn't wearing her hospital gown, but she wasn't going anywhere. And they just started talking about fashion and clothing and, you know, fingernail polish and just the usual things that two young women might talk about in that period, and, you know, just informally. And it was clear to her that this nurse was just oblivious of the fact that she was a patient, that she was changing her ostomy bag. And it just all of a sudden brought life back to her, and she was realizing that, you know, I'm not my disease. And when the nurse left, Naomi decided that she was going to be fine, and she wasn't going to kill herself. And what was so amazing about that story was that the nurse probably never realized that she saved Naomi's life. She was just being herself. She wasn't seeing Naomi as a disease, and she was fully engaged. It was just one young woman chatting with another, and the effect was profound. And I think that's engagement. That's, you know, and I think healthcare professionals greatly underestimate its power.
Yeah, well, you give so many examples throughout the book, but one that really also stuck with me was about a patient early on in the book you call Ms. Dawson, who was going to have a kind of surgery called bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery because I guess she was morbidly obese. And you talk about how the student or resident went in and was doing a preoperative examination and sort of came out to present to you as the senior physician and said, okay, everything's in order, like, let's go ahead and, you know, have this. And you said, well, why is Ms. Dawson, you know, having this surgery? And the answer was, well, she wanted to lose weight so she could better care for her son or something to that effect. And you said, well, what's wrong with her son? And there was sort of this dumbstruck look like, well, I don't know. can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, and so we went into, so again, I think the point is that this offhanded comment of looking forward to taking better care of my son was not something the resident occurred to them to pursue. They're like, well, the son's not my patient. I mean, like, why do I need to ask about that? And but for me, it was like, well, that's kind of an unusual thing for a person to say, even if it's an offhanded comment. And it just, it's like, well, you know, what's going on with your son? So we walked in there, and it turned out it just literally opened up a whole backstory that changed everything. We discovered that, you know, her son was in his early 20s. He was dying of muscular dystrophy, that she was the only one caring for him, that she would have to lift and bathe him, and that she didn't really understand that if she had this surgery, which was going to actually have to be an open procedure, it couldn't be done laparoscopically, she would be unable to lift her son for over a month. And, you know, if she'd gone forward with the surgery, she probably would have tried to do it anyway, which could have been catastrophic. I mean, she could have opened up her abdominal wound. And so anyway, this led to a conversation where she just said, I don't want this surgery now. It's not the right time for me. It would completely ruin what's most important to me. And so we ended up canceling the surgery. And I kind of joked about the fact that, you know, she failed her preoperative testing for psychosocial reasons. But that's what happened. You know, she thought she was just coming in to have an EKG, and that's what the resident thought. But once we learned about what was going on in her life and we got into a conversation with her, the whole thing no longer made sense to her. And I think that's, you know, just the simple question, what's going on with your son? Like, what do you mean you're looking forward to taking care of him? Turned out to be the most important question that we asked.
And I think that's as good as any example of the kind of work you're probably most known for, which is asking the question that's sort of left dangling out there. You and a collaborator by the name of Alan Schwartz have done a number of research studies where you use a method called USPs, as you call them, unannounced standardized patients. Can you talk a little bit about that work? I know this isn't going to do it justice, but what's the point of all that?
Yeah, so we've been so interested and concerned about, you know, like the example I gave you, we found that so often patients have some life issue that is a game changer if you know about it or versus not knowing about it. It could be that they've lost control of a chronic condition like asthma or diabetes because they can't afford a medication, not because they need more medication, or that they're missing appointments because they're a truck driver and they work the night shift. I mean, there's so many things that happen in people's lives. We call them contextual factors. And what we've realized is that sometimes a care plan can look just perfect on paper. You know, it seems like the doctor is following the latest guidelines and so forth, but it's completely inappropriate if you know the patient's life situation, and, you know, like Ms. Dawson. And we call that a contextual error. So it's an inappropriate care plan, not because you prescribed the wrong dose of a drug or you operated on the wrong limb, but because all those things look right, but it wasn't right once you knew the life context of the patient. It was completely the wrong care plan. So we decided to study what we call contextual error, and we've been doing it for many years. I mean, I'm talking over 15 years, and we've used really two methods. One is this kind of special type of secret shopper that we call the unannounced standardized patient. Basically, actors, and we train actors to visit doctors as if they're real patients, and we get doctors to agree to not know when they're seeing a fake patient. And we can create scripts like Ms. Dawson, for instance, and then just see what kind of, you know, and we can train an actor to say something like, you know, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job, or I'm looking forward to taking care of my son, and see what happens. And the actors carry audio recorders, and we can see how physicians vary and what they do. We've also done a lot of studies where we invite real patients to carry audio recorders, and we study it in real patient encounters. And we've actually been doing over 1,000 of those a year. So we've had over 1,000 patients audio recording their visits a year and analyzing that data. So this whole idea of measuring healthcare from the perspective not of, you know, are we prescribing the right drug or the usual things that are measured when we look at quality, but looking at are we adapting care properly to this patient's life situation. That's really been the focus.
Well, it's I don't want to insult the work by asking you to briefly summarize it because there's lots of findings over many, many years, but 1,000 patients a year is quite a data set. And I think we'll have to have you back on the program to talk more in depth about that. But the name of the book is On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Saul Wiener, who is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Saul, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Stay safe out there.